In our last couple of studies in this book, I pointed out the precise fulfillment of prophecies that are detailed throughout this chapter. The angel had revealed to Daniel what was inscribed in the writing of truth, Daniel 10:21 tells us. This is probably the most extensive section of fulfilled prophecy in all Scripture. John Walvoord, in his commentary, commented about that. He said, "This amazingly detailed prophecies of the first 35 verses of this chapter, containing as they do approximately 135 prophetic statements, all now fulfilled, constitute an impressive introduction to the events that are yet future," which will be starting today, starting in verse 36, because now we're going to start looking at things that have not happened. So we're going to be looking at that section, and I'll be pointing out in a minute why I believe this section is still future, while the rest has already been fulfilled. But I want to make a couple comments about prophecy in general and this passage in particular after we read through this whole section so we get the context. So if you'll follow along with me as I read, Daniel chapter 11, starting in verse 36. "Then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. And he will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor shall he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all. But instead, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold, silver, costly stones, and treasures. He will take action against the strongest of fortresses with help of a foreign god. He will give great honor to those who acknowledge him, and he will cause them to rule over the many, and will parcel out land for a price. And at the end time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships. And he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through. He will also enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand, Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. Then he will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape, but he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels. But rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many, and he will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. Now at that time, Michael, the great prince, who stands guard over the sons of your people, will arise. And there will be a time of distress which has never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. And those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness, like the stars forever and ever. But as for you, Daniel, conceal these words and seal up the book until the end of the time. Many will go back and forth, and knowledge will increase." First, notice there in verse 4 of chapter 12 that there is going to be an increase of knowledge from the time of that prophecy. And while it's certainly true there has been an expanse of knowledge in every field of knowledge since the 6th century B.C., I don't think that's what Daniel's talking about. That's not the context here. The context here is future events, both before and after that verse. And since Daniel's prophecy, since the 6th century B.C., we've had more prophecies given. All the post-exilic prophets, including, for example, Zechariah and chapter 14, which is all about future events. Since that time, Jesus Christ has come for the first advent. He has taught us about things that are yet to come. Then we have all the writings of the apostles, including Revelation, which the apostle John wrote. So there has been an increase in our understanding of events that are yet to occur in the future. And they give us additional insight into Daniel as well. Second, look at verse 4, and you see that there's this reference to many going back and forth. The same grammatical structure occurs in Amos 8:12, and so it appears to be a vain quest of running back and forth trying to know what the Lord is saying. And it's a vain quest. There are many who have a very particular interest in future prophecy. They present themselves as experts in the subject.
The result is that has been a massive amount of material written, all of it giving a particular bent of the author towards what he thinks is going to happen. Now, the result of all this is that the more books you read, the more confused you get, because they're trying to make particular things that just we don't know. Every commentary I have on Daniel, including those that are all writing from the same theological perspective, differ widely in how they think the events here in Daniel 11 are going to be played out. When I was growing up, there was usually a prophecy conference every year. I have to admit, over the years, I actually developed a dislike for them. Now, it was always interesting when they'd be talking because they'd like to try and take current events and apply it to prophecy. And it was always interesting at the time. The problem was, as time went on, you found out, well, all their speculations were wrong. And then you started doubting the other things they said. And so I have not really had that great interest in prophecy because of that. We need to understand that figuring out prophecy is very difficult, and there needs to be a lot of humility when we approach it. There are many things that are clear. Some things we actually can be dogmatic about, like Jesus is going to come back. We can be dogmatic about that. But there's a lot of other things, you know what, they could be fulfilled in quite a few different ways. And you will read through the books, you can see very plausible scenarios. We're only going to truly understand the future when we can look back on it and we're past. Much like I think of the apostles, you might recall that they did not understand what Jesus was saying when he's fulfilling all these prophecies. And they didn't get it until after. And then Jesus pointed out to them, and then it was like, you know, oh, now I understand. I think that's going to be the same way for us. We're probably going to understand all these prophecies that are still future for us when we're past that time and can look back and go, why didn't I see it before? But until then, we need to be humble. Some of the things that get confusing, here's a couple of them. The day of the Lord, it occurs in a lot of passages, Old and New Testament. But the descriptions in those passages are very diverse. It becomes very apparent they are talking about different events, different time periods, even though the same name is used. And it takes a lot of careful analysis to try to sort out what passage is talking about what event and what time period. I just mentioned we know Jesus is promised to return from heaven, but there's a diversity of descriptions about it. We know there's got to be at least two events coming under He is coming back. But the relationship between them and the timing and the conjunction with other future events, very widely disputed even among very solid biblical scholars. Now, saying that is not to diminish in the slightest our need for careful study of scriptures and trying to figure out everything we possibly can. We should. We should strive and desire to know what God has said to us. But it is to say that we need to be gracious and humble people. We can be dogmatic, He is coming again. But the particulars, we can be gracious and humble. We should allow some room for disagreement on secondary issues, not only here, but on other issues in Christianity that are secondary. They're not concerning our understanding of what it means to be a Christian, of clear things that are in Scripture, the fundamentals of faith. Churches split over all sorts of things. They split over eschatology and secondary issues within it. Some refuse to have fellowship with those who view it slightly differently. And I think all that really shows is a lack of Christian character maturity. We're humble people, and we don't have to be right about everything. Or if you want to be proud, you can have this mindset. Give the other person enough grace to be wrong. Okay? How's that? That way you can be proud and humble at the same time. Third, understand that the entire prophecy of Daniel 11 and 12 concerns the nation and the land of Israel. We saw that back in Daniel 10:14, which is leading up to the revelation itself. The angel told Daniel, "Now I have come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision pertains to the days yet future." Here at the end of the prophecy, we find it pertains to what will happen to a very evil individual who prosper until the indignation is finished. That's a reference to this time of purging and purifying of the Jews. We will find in Daniel 12:1 that Michael the great prince arises to rescue from Daniel's people, Daniel's people, your people, those were found written in the book. There are major errors in understanding future prophecy that revolve around this issue. They fail to understand who it is written about. Too many Christian theologians and commentators wrongly place the church where then only the nation of Israel belongs. And this is another case of that. Daniel 11 and Daniel 12 specifically concern the nation of Israel as God's chosen people and not the church. And finally, I will be explaining the rest of the book of Daniel from a premillennial, pre-tribulational theological position. Now, if you don't know what that means, I've got a class for you. I'll mention that in a minute. But we have an official doctrinal position of our church. And we've taken that position because we believe it is the best overall explanation of the many, many scriptures that try to explain future events. But we also strive to be humble and gracious to those who hold other positions. But we're confident in our own. And while arguments from other positions certainly point out weaknesses in our own, none yet have proven to be superior or cause any kind of serious doubt. Now, if you're interested in the subject, I can recommend quite a few books. Keep your eye on the bulletin. We are actually going to be dealing with that probably in about a month or two in the theology class I teach on Wednesday nights. I put the topic we're going to talk about that week in the bulletin. Like last week was angelology. What did I put in the bulletin this week? What am I talking about Wednesday?
Angels.
We're continuing on with angels. So just keep your eye on that, and it will come up when it says eschatology. Big word, we're going to be talking about last things. Come on in that Wednesday night and sit on the discussion. Okay? Back to the text, Daniel chapter 11. Now, the first thing to note here is there's a transition between Daniel 11:35 and 11:36. It's a definite transition. Remember last week I pointed out that in Daniel 11:35, it ends open-ended. You have Antiochus Epiphanes, and it's kind of an open-ended statement. Things are left open. There's going to be a refining, a purging, a purifying of the Jews taking place, it says in the text, until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. And then in verse 36, it begins talking about this king who's going to do as he pleases. Now, the previous section was very careful not to refer to Antiochus Epiphanes as a king because he was a usurper. Remember, we talked about that. He, by intrigue, seized the throne. It was not something that was conferred upon him. That honor wasn't conferred. It was seized. So it never talks about him as being king. In addition, though Antiochus Epiphanes was an evil, very despicable man, this guy goes far beyond all that. In addition to that, there is a contrast. The previous section, verses 1 through 35, very detailed prophecies easily coordinated with very specific historical events. From this point on, and in through chapter 12, the events can't be coordinated with things that have happened already. And many have tried. Liberal scholars that say that the previous section was too detailed to be prophecy, therefore it must be written history, look at this section and say it's too vague to be able to coordinate with historical events. Well, which way do they want it? No, it's all specific prophecy. Some of it we're looking back on because time has marched on. This inability has led some to conclude it's fictional and it's fulfilled metaphorically. So you'll read in commentaries that some will say it's Antiochus Epiphanes. Some will say it's Herod the Great, Constantine the Great, the Pope, the Roman Empire, Hitler, Stalin, or whoever else no one likes. It's not any of those. It is no person, historical person, or system. This is a man who is yet to come. And this detailed prophecy about him is going to be fulfilled in the future. This man is the little horn in the prophecy of Daniel 7 we looked at a few months ago. He is often referred to as the Antichrist. That's who we're talking about. Verses 36 through 38 give us a description of him, his character. First says that he is a king who will do as he pleases. This is a man who regards no law except himself, which is why Paul describes him in 2 Thessalonians 2:3 as the man of lawlessness. In Daniel 7:25, he's described as someone who seeks to make alterations even in time and in law. He is a dictatorial despot. The description of him in these verses is not necessarily chronological with verses 40 through 45. In fact, it's my own conclusion that his actions in what happens in those later verses reveal the character that is described here. He is the supreme egotist. He disregards all gods and all religions in favor of himself. Now, there have been many men who have thought of themselves as some sort of god, but they also usually recognize some other god. That was true of the Caesars. It was also true of Antiochus Epiphanes. He thought himself a manifestation of Zeus, but he certainly recognized many other gods. There are seven statements this man makes in just three verses regarding his relationship to the gods. First, it says he will exalt and magnify himself above every god. Next, it says he'll speak monstrous things. I know some of your text says wonderful. Don't think of wonderful as a good. Think as in spectacular, amazing, unbelievable. Monstrous things against the God of gods. He will show no regard for the God of his fathers. He will show no regard for the desire of women. He will show no regard for any god. He will magnify himself above them all, and the only god he will honor is a god of fortresses. This man is an atheist. He is not only set against the true God, he is also set against the promised Messiah, and he has no respect for any religion. The grammatical construction of the phrase desire of women bears out the idea that this desire of women is not a desire for women. Some have tried to take the text that way and say he's a homosexual. That's not what it says. Haggai 2:7, 1 Samuel 9:20 have the same grammar. It's the desire that women would have, not a desire some would have for the woman. Now, what desire would the women have in a context you're speaking about gods? The ancient desire that the Jewish women had that they would be the mother of the Messiah. That was their desire. That was their longing. That would be their prayer, that they might be the mother of Messiah. And remember, this is prior to Messiah's coming the first time, and so that's what Daniel's referring to. Before and after, it's only talking about gods. He rejects Messiah. One reason we call him Antichrist is because he fits the definition. In 1 John, the Apostle John said, "Children, this is the last hour, and just as you heard that Antichrist is coming, a real person will be coming in the future." He goes on and says, "Even now many antichrists have arisen, for this we know that is the last hour." There are many that follow suit. How do you define it? What is an antichrist? What will characterize this man? Well, we are told. 1 John 2:22, the apostle defines him as the one who denies the Father and the Son. 1 John 4:3, the one that does not confess Jesus. 2 John 1:7, those that do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. This is part of his character. He denies Christ. Now, other scriptures also speak of this man's blasphemous character. In Daniel 7, he's described as the one who will utter great boasts, Daniel 7:8-11. In verse 25 of Daniel 7, it says he will speak out against the Most High. Arrogance as well. He's described in 2 Thessalonians 2:4 as the one, quote, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. That would be the abomination of desolation spoken about by Jesus in Matthew 24:15 in reference to the first speaking of it in Daniel 9:27, the prophecy of it. The description in Revelation 13 agrees with this. He is the beast out of the sea who opens his mouth and blasphemies against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle. Those who dwell on the earth will worship him, and those that will refuse to worship him are subject to execution. That's the character of this man. The only God he recognizes is the God of fortresses. This is not a personified gods such as the Greek or Roman gods. They had the Roman with the god Mars, the god of war. This is not a personification of it. This is war itself is his god. That's what it's talking about. And in fact, the text itself describes it as his devotion. His time, his abilities, energies, his finances all go into it. Look at there at Daniel 11:38, describing his wealth and his given in this pursuit of war as an act of religious homage. He will honor the god of fortresses with gold, silver, costly stones, and treasures. His actions of war are then described in verses 39 and then in 40 through 45. Now, because he has these blasphemous beliefs, he takes actions, and he will attack even the strongest fortresses. He's not a fearful man in the least. And he conquers. He then parcels out honor to those who acknowledge him. And to those willing to pay the price, he will set them up as puppet kings over the territories conquered. That price certainly would include wealth and treasure, but it'll also include really their souls, because they will have to end up worshiping this blasphemous despot. Other scriptures describe these kinds of actions, but they give us some hope, because it says there's also a limit to what he will do. In Daniel 7:25, it says he wears down the saints of the highest one for a time, times, and half a time before he is judged and then destroyed. Here in Daniel 11:36, it said, "It's given him to prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done." He will come to an end. In Revelation 17, the peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues are personified as a harlot, and the ten horns and the beast are going to make that harlot desolate, naked, eat her up, and burn her with fire. The beast, the Antichrist, is allied with these puppet kings, is going to conquer. He's going to consume. He's going to destroy other nations in war. But that only continues, as verse 17, Revelation 17 says, until the words of God are fulfilled. It's going to be bad, but there's a limit. And it won't go past that limit. It's already been decreed. Now, the next section can be confused because there's some question about whether it's referring to two kings or three and how it coordinates with other future prophecy. This section begins describing that at the end time, the king of the south is going to collide with him, and if the him is the king of the north, then there's two kings, and the king of the north is the Antichrist. If the him there is Antichrist, then the king of the north represents a separate power, and there's three kings. I hold that it's probably three kings. I think that better fits the context and the flow of the grammar within that verse itself. Now, before we look at this in a little more detail, remember a couple things here about the actions that are going to take place. First of all, according to Daniel 7, this Antichrist is the little horn, and that little horn arises out of the ten horns that are part of the revived Roman Empire. That's his origin. So he does not have an origin coming out of Palestine, Israel. His origin is out of what used to be the Roman Empire. So it'd be Europe is where he's going to be coming from. Second, the focus of the prophetic scriptures here is Israel. It's Israel itself. And I pointed out before, sometimes you'll see language where it talks about all the earth. It's referring to what's taken over Israel. And that's a possibility here as well. The Antichrist is given power to conquer, and he does so at will. It doesn't necessarily mean he's conquered every single nation upon the planet. It also does not mean that those nations he conquers and sets up as puppet kings are going to remain loyal. In fact, we know they do not remain loyal because he continues to have battles, as described even in this section. Recall as well that the 70th week of the prophecy in Daniel 9:27 begins with this, "And he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week." The he is the Antichrist. He is the prince that is to come. And the prince is of the people that destroy Israel, which are the Romans. And the many are the Jews. It is this covenant that he makes with the nation of Israel that brings him into conflict. An attack on Israel becomes an attack on him because he has a firm covenant with them. It's assumed the king of the south's collision with him, the kings of the north storm against him in verse 40, are toward the direction of Israel. They're pushing both down upon Israel. And that's certainly possible, and this covenant would mean that is attack on him. But it also does not exclude these rising powers that are rebelling from attacking him in other places. We know this is a major military action. Look at what the king of the north attacks with. It says it's a strong force. Many chariots with horsemen and many ships. There's naval action going on as well. This is major conflict. Well, the Antichrist's response to this is overwhelming. Look at verse 40 through 43. Verse 40, the end of it says, he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through. Verse 41 then continues, he will also enter the beautiful land, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand, Edom, Moab, and the foremost, the sons of Ammon. Then he will stretch out his hand from against other countries, the land of Egypt will not escape. But he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels. Now, the beautiful land is a reference to Israel. And from there, he then continues on to conquer Egypt, all the way to the borders of Libya and Ethiopia. And that means he has to have defeated the king of the north and then come sweeping down, passes through Israel. And it appears that he is so focused on crushing the king of the south, he doesn't bother to head east at all. And so Ammon, Edom, Moab, all those areas are now within what is modern Jordan. He skips those and he continues south and crushes Egypt. In doing so, he gains control of wealth of all those areas. And there will be something down there. It says that there's these hidden treasures of gold and silver that we don't know about. Who knows what he finds? But he finds vast wealth when he does this. Then verse 44 describes something very disturbing to him. He's crushed this rebellion. It looks good for him. And as soon as this victory and he can start celebrating it, he gets rumors. Verse 44, but rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. Now I find this verse very intriguing for the following reasons, and these are my own speculations, okay? Let me put that up. This is my own speculation. This is a man whose only God is the God of fortresses, the God of war. He's not a man who, in fact, I had to put it this way, he's a man who probably relishes war. He likes war. It's something he likes to do. So I can't find here why the possibility of having another war, another more battles, would cause him this kind of emotional reaction of very great wrath. In fact, I think he would be sort of elated. Remember, he just said he went down, and we know that Edom, Moab, and Ammon, he's not conquered because those there are safe. And one of these is these rumors coming out of the east. Opportunity. I can go east. We don't know how far he had conquered previously, and I will conquer more land and more territory. That seemed to me that the nature of this guy would be a positive thing from his sick mindset. But there is something here that would disturb him very much and probably cause very great wrath. And it's this king's, these rumors out of the north. Remember, he already has come from that direction. His power base is Europe. He has swept out of Europe, come from the north, and swept through Israel down to Egypt. Where does a rebellion now in the north come from? A rebellion, a treasonous rebellion. These are lands he'd already conquered. So his puppet kings are defying him now. That would cause him great wrath. Now again, that's my speculation, but it makes sense to me. Why would he have such wrath for a man who loves war? So there is rebellion going on with his kingdom. Verse 45. So he goes forward, and it says he destroys and he annihilates. So he's victorious. Verse 45 gives us an idea that, yes, he is. Notice it says, he will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. The chronology in verse 40 through 44 may be the very actions that brings Antichrist into residence in Israel, probably near Jerusalem, which is the place between the seas. The seas are Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea, and the beautiful mountain. That'd be Mount Zion. And while it's difficult to coordinate chronology here in these verses with other major future prophetic passages, Ezekiel 38 and 39, Zechariah 14, Matthew 24, the book of Revelation, this is one of the things that makes you humble. For example, all the commentators I had put Ezekiel's prophecy of Israel being invaded by Gog and Magog, which are up in the north, which is also in alliance with several other nations, in different places here in Daniel 11:40 through 45. Some place it with the verses 40-41, it's early in, some place it at verse 44, and some place at the end of verse 45. That's just in the commentaries I've got. I lean to thinking that Daniel 11:40 through 45 occurs during the first part of the 70th week of Daniel's 70th week prophecy. Remember, the 70th week has not come yet. That the first half of this, which is prior to the abomination of desolation, it would fit well with and coordinate with at least the wars, the rumors of wars, the nations rising against nation in Matthew 24, 6 through 8. It also coordinate well with at least the first four seals of judgment in Daniel 6, of conquering, of war, of famine, and death. At the end of Daniel 45, there is a statement, "Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him." So there is this, he's now at peace, and then there's a statement, but he's going to come to an end. I find that I think this fits well at the end. That last section is the second half of the 70th week. And that then would coordinate with the rest of Matthew 24, Revelation chapter 7 through 19, Ezekiel 38 and 39, and Zechariah 14. Ezekiel 38 and 39 in particular are very difficult to coordinate because it begins with a period of Israel dwelling securely. Ezekiel 28:8 states that. It's secure. And if you have all these wars going back and forth and armies marching through your territory, it just doesn't sound secure to me. So there has to be some stability there when Gog, Magog, and all the other allies come down and then are destroyed in a very supernatural way. Ezekiel 28:19 says there's this great earthquake. Then 28:20 says a lot of the army will kill themselves. The armies fight each other instead of attacking their supposed target. And then most of them all die from, verse 21 says, from pestilence, torrential rain, hailstones, fire, and brimstone. That doesn't sound pleasant. And it is definitely not a military action. Military actions don't call torrential rain. It doesn't bring down this fire and brimstone. And then verse 22 of Ezekiel 28 says very specifically, this is also that the Lord is sanctified and made known among the nations. That isn't implied here in this first section, or this section we're dealing with in Daniel 11. And then if we go on to chapter 12, verse 1, I think this lends support to this conclusion. Notice it says, verse 1, "Now at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people, will arise. And there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued." Now again, "your people" occurs twice in this verse, so it's dealing with Israel, Daniel's people, the Jews. Now the phrase "now at that time" refers to the end time of 11 verse 40. And it could be understood to be concurrent, or it could be understood to be subsequent. But this statement about a time of previously unknown distress can only fit within the latter half of Daniel's 70th week. Nothing in the previous verses begins to compare with the great tribulation that's described in Matthew 24, 21 through 31, or the trumpet and vial judgments in Revelations 8 through 16. It specifically says it's a time of distress that it was unknown previously, greater than anything that occurred before it, described the same way in Matthew, described the same way in Revelation. Now this Michael, And I have to mention this because you see strange things in commentaries. This Michael is the same Michael that was introduced in Daniel 10:13. He is an archangel. Jude 1:9 tells us that. And he has a specific responsibility toward the nation of Israel. This is not Christ. It is not any other human or spiritual person. I don't know where some people get these kind of speculations, but there are several that go off that direction. It is the archangel Michael. His specific purpose in this text is to protect and rescue the remnant of Israel whose names are written in the book. And that is what he will do. And again, the phrase, your people, occurring twice, puts the emphasis. Michael's actions concern Daniel's people, the Jews. No reference, no allusion to the church in this verse. There's been also some questions of what action Michael actually takes. That's because there's been a misunderstanding of the term translated arise in a few Bible translations, including the NASB. Oh, it didn't come out well. That does not look like Hebrew, does it? Well, I guess I don't have the right font in that computer. It's on my computer and looks really good. It actually is pretty easy to see. Well, you can see there's several characters there that are the same. That should give you some sense that these words may be related. You can try and figure out which characters are the same. Actually, for many of you, that probably looks as understandable as Hebrew would. Except for Steve. You understand it, right?
That's easy
to understand. Okay. You understand both.
And Greek
too. Okay. The words here, the King James, New King James, Young's, Darby's, they do a better translating. If you have one of those, it translates this as stand up because it's keeping with the related verb in the same verse, stand watch or stand guard. The words here, Ya'amad and Ha'amad, are forms of the same verb, Amad. You got that? Yeah, sure, you got it. Okay? Two verb forms of the same verb. And so whatever you can do with them, they've got to be related. You can't have one mean one thing and one mean something else. He does not arise or stand up in the sense of getting up and leaving. He stands up, he arises to his full height and fulfills the responsibility he has of standing guard, protecting this remnant of Jews whose names are written in the book. He's the one who rescues them. He is the one that protects them in the midst of a time that it can't really even be described. When you read through Revelation, the things that are going on there, when you read through Matthew 24 of this time that is unprecedented, something supernatural is going to have its hand on you, his hand upon you, if you're going to survive. And Michael does that. That's Michael. The next couple of verses jump to the resurrection of the righteous that follow this time. And I'll cover that in depth next week. This morning, I only want to point out that the angel doesn't leave Daniel in frustration. Because he goes on. He's going to go on even to the end of the chapter 12. The angel gives a revelation of things that are absolutely horrible that are coming. More so for Daniel, because remember, the past history we're looking at was still forward for him. But he gets to the end and lets them know, God has not lost control. He still even has his angel there to protect the ones he has chosen, those written in the book. And there's going to be a resurrection that's going to be a wonderful blessing on the other side. There is both a remnant and a future resurrection of the righteous. And we need to keep that in mind for ourselves because the same thing is true for us, even as believers. There are horrible things we may face in the future. Remember when I started even talking about prophecy, most people have this curiosity about what will happen in the future. But let's face it, we only want to know that if it's going to be good for us. We don't want to know if there's going to be bad things. We'd rather not know. But as Christians, we have a sovereign God, and we are in his hands. Whatever we go through, whatever we may have to face, God doesn't lose control. He still has us in his hands. And he will enable us and carry us through whatever is necessary. The goal of our lives isn't peace and security and having a good time. It's holiness, righteousness, and glorifying the God who created us. And he will enable us to do that in every single circumstances. That's what Paul said in Philippians 4:11, usually quoted out of context, but I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I can live a godly life and respond and still be content no matter what happens. Jesus told us in John 16:33, "These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation, but take courage. I have overcome the world."